You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 9th of June 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, a deadly attack on Karachi's international airport claims at least 28 lives. Are these new tactics for the Taliban? Kathleen Burke and Darren McCaffrey will give us their analysis. Plus, Hillary Clinton's made $5 million in speaking fees over the past year. What's her reasoning?
We came out of the White House not only dead broke, but in debt. We had no money when we got there, and we struggled to, you know, piece together the resources for mortgages, for houses, for Chelsea's education. You know, it was not easy.
It's tough at the top. We'll ask whether a potential future US president should be allowed to make such a huge sum of money. And we'll discuss whether all the bad World Cup publicity is just bullying from Western media outlets. And also see if Pope Francis could be the key to peace in the Middle East. Also ahead.
Oh, I love to climb a mountain and to reach the highest peak.
Oh yes, I've got my dinner jacket on because we're going to be looking back at the golden age of film musicals with the author of a new book on the genre. All that, plus we'll check out some of what our correspondents around the world are doing today and bring you some music too. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House, but before any of that, here's Bill Bingham with the latest news.
Monocle 24 News. Pakistan's busiest airport has reopened after a night-long assault by Taliban militants in which at least 28 people were killed. The violence at Jinnah International Airport in Karachi began just before midnight when 10 gunmen wearing military uniforms and armed with automatic rifles and grenades shot their way into the terminal building. Gun battles continued through the night until security forces regained control of the airport at dawn. Passengers were evacuated and all flights were diverted. Hours after the airport was secured, passengers started arriving to catch their flights, some of them nervously. But this passenger, Mrs. Hisham, had a defiant message for the attackers.
Nothing is impossible for them. So we have to return the message in the same way, that nothing is impossible for us as well. This is our country, this is our mulke, hamara mulke.
Indian security officials have increased security at airports in large cities following a deadly attack. Paramilitary soldiers and police officers were patrolling the streets around Mumbai's Chhatrapati Shivaji International Airport and carrying out vehicle security checks. Karachi journalist Beena Shah told Monocle 24 it was a desperate move by the Taliban.
The fact that they're striking at a target such as an airport as opposed to an air base or an army installation means that they have lost some power. They aren't able to retaliate against the army as such or the air force, so they're going for the softer targets. They have managed to find a security leak and a hole in the security, so that's what they went for. They probably studied this for quite some time.
A Spanish Air Force pilot has died after his Eurofighter jet crashed at a military base in southern Spain. Local media say the aircraft crashed into the ground while attempting to land at Morón base, 35 miles southeast of Seville. The base is shared by Spain and the US Air Force, but only Spain operates the Eurofighter. Reports say the plane was taking part in a routine training exercise. Brazilian riot police have been using tear gas against protesters in Sao Paulo 3 days before the World Cup opening game in the city's main stadium. The protest was called by metro workers who are striking in support of a 12.2% salary increase. Brazil's president, Dilma Rousseff, says she won't allow violent demonstrations to mar the World Cup. Sao Paulo's metro workers have been on strike since Thursday, creating traffic chaos in one of the world's most congested cities. Monocle's correspondent in Brazil, Sheena Rossiter, says there could be serious disruption of the opening World Cup events.
The governor, Geraldo Alckmin, has made public statements basically saying that these workers do have to go back to work and the court is pushing them to go back to work. However, no one is wanting to go back to work, which could wreak some serious havoc with kickoff between Brazil and Croatia happening at the Reino Corinthians in Sao Paulo this Thursday.
Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe says Japan is to increase efforts to resume whale hunting in the Antarctic. the International Court of Justice ruled in March that Japan's whaling program was not for scientific research as they had claimed. The case against them was brought by Australia in 2010 and backed by New Zealand. Japan stopped the annual Antarctic hunt after the ruling, but vessels have continued to kill minke whales along Japan's northern coast. It claims these are also for research purposes. A Moscow court has sentenced two men to life in prison for killing an investigative journalist whose murder in 2006 raised international alarm. Anna Politkovskaya, who specialised in uncovering state corruption and rights abuses, was gunned down at her Moscow apartment block at the age of 48. Five men were found guilty of the killing last month. The other three were given sentences of between 12 and 20 years. The world's oldest man has died in his New York City home at the age of 111. Alexander Imich, who was born in Poland in 1903, emigrated to the United States in the 1950s. The gerontology research group in Torrance, California, says he turned 111 in February and assumed the oldest living title in May. Mr. Imich, who did not have children, said good genes were responsible for his long life. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Bill. It's 18.06 here. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and we're right back after this.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Outlondo, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House. And the time here in London is 18.07, which means it's 13.07 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Kathleen Burke from University College London and Darren McCaffrey from Sky News. Welcome both to the programme. Now, our top story today, as you'll have heard in the headlines, is that the Taliban has claimed responsibility for a deadly attack on Karachi's international airport that's claimed at least 28 lives. In a brazen assault, terrorists stormed Pakistan's largest airport in the hopes of destroying a fleet of aircraft and thereby crippling the country's aviation industry. Well, earlier today, we spoke to the Karachi-based commentator Bina Shah, who gave us her assessment of the attack and its aftermath.
They were very well trained and they were very well armed, so we cannot think of them in any way as defanged or weakened as such. But the fact that they're striking at a target such as an airport as opposed to an air base or an army installation means that they have lost some power. They aren't able to retaliate against the army as such or the air force, so they're going for the softer targets. They have managed to find a security leak and a hole in the security, so that's what they went for. They probably studied this for quite some time. The Karachi airport is laid out in such a way that the newer terminal is where all the international flights and the commercial flights come in. The older terminal is where there's cargo and engineering and then the Hajj flights. So they saw that the older terminal was not as well protected as the newer terminal, and that's where they infiltrated.
Well, that was the commentator Bina Shah there. Well, the head of Pakistan's Taliban said that the attacks were retaliation, for a US drone strike that killed Commander Abdullah Baha and pledged that more attacks were imminent. So does this represent a new tactic for the Taliban in Pakistan? Kathleen, let's start with you. It was suggested there by Bina Shah that, you know, they went for a softer target because actually they're not doing very well in the attack stakes, as it were. But do you think that's correct?
Well, there are a lot of softer targets, of course. And as softer targets go, that was a harder one, I think. There were security guards there. So there was a danger. I mean, blowing up a market, for example, now that's a soft target. But it's interesting because Karachi has changed so much over the past several years and that there's been a huge influx of Pashtuns from the northwest. So one wonders whether it's going to be easier for the Taliban in Karachi after this because they have a lot of safe houses, which makes it a softer, hard target, if you see what I mean.
Darren, these attacks, they're always about terror and about, you know, scaring people. But again, we heard in the clips there that people are a bit determined these days. There have been so many attacks.
Yeah, I mean, a battle-hardened kind of Pakistan in some ways. I mean, I think, first of all, it should be said that even though this is a kind of hard soft target, it is in Karachi, which will, of course, worry the Pakistanis because that is the commercial and economic hub of Pakistan. But I think you're right in saying that this is, I mean, a reminder that, I think, to the international community, that the Taliban remain a very potent threat in particular Pakistan, but also be a blow to the new government in Pakistan. That this is a country that wants to say we're on the front foot, that we want to attract foreign investment, that we are being politically stable again, particularly with the election of Nawaz Sharif last year. And the whole emphasis has been on trying to, you know, kind of to try and build up Pakistan's economy again. And a blow to somewhere like an airport in Karachi is big, and that's a big blow to that strategy.
Karen? I was going to say there seems to be two ideas. I think first, you're quite right that it's the industrial and economic and agricultural center and so forth. So you hit the node there. But also one gets the impression they were also trying to hijack
some of
the planes, which puts terror in a different sort of thing. They're taking it out of Karachi. Heaven knows where.
Precisely. And I think actually if there is one thing to take away from this is that they didn't manage to do that. And that's a sign that actually, at these kind of hard soft targets, that there is security and that the Pakistanis are pretty well trained in trying to combat this form of terrorism. But yeah, I think in one of the articles today talk about someone on a plane as it was preparing to take off, seeing these explosions and the terror on board. Now, that is not going to be an attractive report to Westerners or to anyone from the international community who might think about investing in Pakistan. And ultimately, it's kind of a vicious cycle, Pakistan's economy has been on its knees now for the last at least certainly decade or so. And it is only with economic progress that you can really, in some ways, tackle the root causes of the terrorism that it's sparking in the first place.
Yeah, and I think actually when you saw the tarmac today at the Jinnah International Airport, there's no BA or anything there. Those airlines have already pulled out, so it's already kind of local airlines there. Catherine, on the bigger issue here, I guess, is, you know, what the strategy is for the Pakistani government, because they had been looking at negotiations with the Taliban. Does that mean that that's an end, or this is kind of a tit for tat, and then they will move on with some kind of diplomacy in the background?
Well, the precedents for peace talks with the Taliban are not good, of course. The last time they tried it seriously, the Taliban used the opportunity to regroup and to move into a different province. The trouble is the prime minister's whole sort of credibility is tied up now with the idea of successful peace talks with the Taliban. He doesn't really have any other place to go unless he says, "I was wrong, I was wrong." So in larger terms, the Taliban, I don't think, they don't want peace talks. How do they have to gain from peace talks when they already control a good quarter of the country? There's nothing in it for them.
Darren, I guess they gain keeping some of their people alive a bit longer. They want the drone strikes stopped.
Yeah, precisely. But then again, at the same time, I mean, what is Pakistan's role in stopping these drone strikes? I mean, Cathy's going to know an awful lot more about this than I am, but I would have thought that actually these drone strikes are going to the behest of particularly the United States, and one assumes often ignoring the advice of the Pakistanis in the first place. So
That's unsure. I mean, one gets the impression that although we all place it on Obama and the U.S. government, they do it in conjunction, in with dialogue with at least part of the Pakistani army, that's not wholly the Americans coming in like
unless the Taliban feel that the Pakistanis are almost wholly in control of this, because we know there have been incidents where at least the Pakistanis have claimed they were unaware of some drone strikes, I would have thought the Taliban would then be reluctant to...
And what are they going to say? Yes, yeah, we knew and we're going to let them kill our people. This is not possibly a viable approach for the Pakistani government. No, I mean, Pakistan is split. You know, part of the armed forces are, as we know, have been for years infiltrated by members of the Taliban. The other part are resentful because they're losing control of their country. In a sense, it depends on who you talk to, doesn't it?
Well, we're going to leave the conversation there, a very great start to the show, but because we're going to talk about FIFA now and the World Cup. The World Cup will open on Thursday in Sao Paulo, and the city is currently in the grips of a strike by metro workers. More bad news for World Cup organisers as traffic jams threaten to disrupt the opening match. Well, earlier today, police fired tear gas on protesters who were supporting the striking workers. It just makes for more negative headlines for the world's media to run with. But is this criticism fair, or is Brazil being unnecessarily targeted? Now, we'll start with you, Darren, on the media side of this story. Do you think that there's just a kind of an inevitable coverage about every one of these big sporting events? You're in the run-up to it, we're critical, we say, oh, they'll never get it organised, it's going to be a disaster. It happened here with the London Olympics, with Sochi. Then it starts and everyone forgets all about it and we're cheering and we're watching the football and we don't care.
Precisely. I mean, every media outlet or every event needs a narrative, and the narrative with Brazil has, it isn't a great Brazil's been given this World Cup. It's a real sign that this is a country that's bouncing onto the world stage, but actually, have we given it to it too soon? And that has been the narrative, certainly I think of the Western press over the last 2 or 3 years, not obviously helped by the fact that in lots of regards, Brazil hasn't been managed to keep up with the programme that they committed themselves to. And that there is genuine disquiet. I think the disquiet on the streets of places like São Paulo and Rio de Janeiro may be slightly exaggerated. Lots of Brazilians feel quite strongly that public money has been diverted from what is a football tournament, so diverted away from public services like health and roads and infrastructure to pay for what is ultimately a football tournament. And we can overestimate this is a footballing nation, Brazil, and that they all love it no matter what. That's clearly not true. There clearly is unease about the amount of public money being devoted to this. At the same time, I think most Brazilians seem very proud that they're hosting the World Cup. And you're right. Once this starts, and I undoubtedly think it will be a success, and Brazil is a big footballing nation. Once it starts, once nations starts playing, it's the United States against Ghana next week.
Exciting.
Excited. I'm excited. England, I'm not even English, but England are playing Italy on Saturday. Once it starts, people will get behind it and have enormously good fun. And I think ultimately it'll be very, very good for Brazil and will put them in a good position for the Olympic Games, of course, in 2 years' time.
Catherine, I think what's good about Brazil is that they're not kind of saying everything's perfect in our country. And they're actually kind of presenting really what the reality is. I see that today the English football team, they were going to Racinha, the largest favela in Rio de Janeiro. They're kind of saying, look, we have all these issues. You know, we do have like huge amounts of informal settlements. Get on with it. You know, this is our country. Come and see the kind of richness that we've got. Do you think that is actually, for Brazil, it's quite an exciting moment to get their story across? Sure, it's great when, you know, the UK has, you know, the Olympics, but in the end, you just get a few more grannies going to, you know, Buckingham Palace from around the world. But for Brazil, this is rebranding on a massive scale, isn't it?
Well, it is, and that's why it has to succeed, of course. Remember India.
Well, we do. We remember sewage and kind of people trying to do the Commonwealth Games with no water and things. But that wasn't India.
It wasn't. But again, when it did start, though, that was quickly forgotten, wasn't it? I mean, that was the because there's nothing to talk about in the build up.
Probably a little bit less quickly in the case of India, to be fair.
Yeah. I mean, there are things happening in Brazil. Obviously, we've been reading for 6 months, a year, 18 months about the favelas and the cleaning up the drugs and people getting pushed out of their homes and so forth. I think it's going to depend in many respects whether they object and go for that sort of personal thing, or they're going to all of a sudden become Brazilian in the sense of backing the team, not so much Brazil as the Brazilian team. I mean, there's a certain fanaticism. Brazil's won the World Cup 5 times, hasn't it?
Yeah.
More than any other country. So I suspect that once it gets started, I agree, that things will...
Darren, what does a victory for brand Brazil look like at the World Cup?
Well, I think it is kind of... It's reaffirming its now position as a kind of pretty big global player in terms of economics. I think there are two serious points for Brazil. First of all is it's now sluggish economic growth. We're talking about potentially only growth of 0.2% this quarter in Brazil. That is not good for a country that is not fully developed in terms of its economics yet, and it should be doing a lot better. And of course, the second aspect of all this is FIFA. and FIFA's role and suspected corruption, which has really kind of taken off. We heard yesterday from many of the sponsors of the World Cup that they're now concerned. Money talks. And I think ultimately, even though we will get caught up in that kind of football over the next month or so, I think the residue from all this, looking ahead to Russia in 2018, Qatar in 2020, will be about FIFA and its role and how it's handled these bids from across the world. And I think that might be the story, that actually it was the kind of Brazilian World Cup that proved the kind of the kickoff to all that in regards to FIFA, because I think there will be significant change in the next few years. But as I say, I think when that whistle is blown on the football pitch, everyone becomes football fans.
Brazilians are going to really like being seen as the kickoff for dealing with crime. Let's hope there's a bit better memory than that.
Good. Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Kathleen Burke and Darren McCaffrey. When we return, we'll hear whether it's appropriate for a US potential presidential candidate to cash in on public speaking, and we'll also ask whether Pope Francis could offer the key to peace in the Middle East.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more, but I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
Well, welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck. And joining me here on the programme today is Kathleen Burke and Darren McCaffrey. Well, it's a big day for Hillary Clinton tomorrow. No, she's not announcing that she's running for the White House, but rather her new book, Hard Choices, comes out. It's raising speculation that Clinton is setting the stage for a presidential run after the November midterms. But perhaps some unwanted criticism is coming her way too. During an interview with Diane Sawyer to promote her book, Clinton was made to answer questions over the $5 million she's made in public speaking fees since leaving the State Department. Clinton defended herself by saying the family was not only dead broke, but also in debt. Let's have a listen.
We came out of the White House not only dead broke, but in debt. We had no money when we got there, and we struggled to, you know, piece together the resources for mortgages, for houses, for Chelsea's education. You know, it was not easy.
Well, there's quite a few questions to talk about here, but you know, should she be raising money that she obviously could potentially use as a presidential candidate as for her bid? But first of all, Darren, just do you think it's going to go really rubbish with kind of American voters when they hear someone saying, actually, you know, I was so broke, I needed $5 million just to kind of help my daughter get on in the world, and you know, we were a bit short of cash. Maybe I'm misreading what happens between Europe and the US, but it just sounds a bit kind of strange, kind of electorate message.
I think there will be resentments. I mean, we know in Europe, for example, many of their leaders, not least, for example, Tony Blair has gone on to earn an awful lot of money from public speaking, and I think lots of people do slightly resent that. However, I think Hillary Clinton has got a case in that. I mean, her case effectively is that, particularly for their family, that they were in public office really since the late 70s on kind of fixed salaries. They could have earned an awful lot of money. They had to fight some legal battles that we're all very aware of. That cost money, and actually they didn't earn an awful lot, and they accrued quite a lot of debt, and that this is available to them. And why wouldn't they do it? Now, that $5 million, it must said, dwarfs the kind of $89 million apparently that her husband has made since he's left office. And also, I don't know, I mean, Kathy, you more American, maybe Americans will think actually this is quite enterprising and, you know, that this is absolutely fine.
I think it's a ridiculous situation, I must say. I mean, would they rather she went and sold herself to oil companies and banks and so forth? At least she's going out in public doing it herself. And tell me that that Mitt Romney didn't do that. Tell me that any other...
This is someone who actually has an awful lot to give. I mean, I have to say, I hope her book out tomorrow or today is a hell of a lot better than her previous book, which was very, very, very dull. But she's actually a very good public speaker. I've gone to see her quite a few times, and she's got an awful lot to add. I mean, as a former Secretary of State, not that long ago, she's got an awful lot to add.
Kathleen, on the American perspective, it's interesting what you say about her, because, you know, actually, if she was a European politician, you know, we've seen it here in the UK, people make, like, you know, £5,000 for an after-dinner speech, and they're kind of like lambasted, you know, through all the papers. How dare they be making money off what they did, as, you know, while they're in public office? But actually, in the American context, people don't seem to mind, do they? That people, it's expected that presidents will have a prosperous career on the speaking circuit.
Yes, and one must remember that, you know, Obama and Clinton and some of the others were rather young presidents. You know, and if you've been president, well, one former president went off and became Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and another went back as a congressman. But it's hard to imagine anyone, any president like that, going back or perhaps running General Motors. We wouldn't like that. They have to live somehow. I think there's a great deal of media hypocrisy involved in all this.
And just your reading of the runes, do you think that she is kind of lining up for that presidential bid?
I would take my oath on it. I mean, there's one, you know, perhaps coming up in the sides, Elizabeth Warren, but, you know, no one else is going to put their head above the parapet unless she says she's not going to do it.
Kathy, I think what you have to remember, there is a career after being president. Of course, you could take up painting, for example, which has been
Churchill,
which has been enormous success for George W. Bush. But there we go.
Well, we're going.
Maybe it's better she sticks to talking.
We have one more. We have one more.
This is in public.
Well, yes. True.
We have one more topic to get in before the end of the programme. We're going to discuss the historic meeting that took place yesterday at the Vatican City between Pope Francis, the Israeli President Shimon Peres, and the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. It was dubbed the Day of Prayer, with the hope of rekindling peace in the Middle East. So could Pope Francis be the key to the peace between both sides? Kathleen, we'll start with you. Do you think he can be?
No. I mean, what can he do in the sense...
Did they just turn up because it would have been embarrassing to turn down the invitation?
No. I mean, well, I suppose there's something. I mean, it was very good for Abbas, of course. Any invitation like that is very good for him as representing the Palestinian people. Shimon Peres is 90 or 91, and he's only president for another month, and he doesn't have any influence in Israel from what one understands. So in terms of peace, no. But in terms of lifting the public notice of Palestine, I think it's a rather good thing for Abbas. I don't, what do I know? Who knows the inward knowledge of a man? I have no idea why the Pope did it, except that peace is a good thing, and that's perhaps if he can do anything, like stopping things for 15 minutes, one can't really complain.
Do you think there's a role here for a Catholic sitting in between a Jewish person and a Muslim to kind of try and negotiate between, you know, do they bring an independent perspective? What do you think the role of the Pope here?
Well, I think that's the most interesting aspect of this, is kind of where Pope Francis sees himself in the world. We all know that popes have prayed for peace. I think the thing about Pope Francis, actually, he feels that he kind of has to be a bit more of a proactive Pope. We know he does that in regards to kind of his take on poverty. He doesn't just kind of talk about poverty. He actually tries to kind of deal with, in some ways, whether it's simply kind of trying to, you know, kind of verbally bully governments into doing stuff or highlight the plight of some people. And I think when it comes to this, he actually has a sense that Jerusalem and the Middle East is incredibly important to Jewish people, to Muslims, but also to Christians. It is the foundation, and I think he's got a special interest in that. And so I think by the very essence that he's trying, even if he is just trying to bring two people together into the one room, even if it is to pray, I think that, well, it's better than nothing, or it's better than what we've seen previous popes do, which is simply just talk about it and actually not do an awful lot.
Kathleen, you want to jump in?
Well, it's just that, okay, you're a Muslim in the Middle East, and what do you associate the Catholic Church with? The Crusades. Now, how is this going to wear? Is this going to have a back blow against Abbas? I mean, the point is, he's a man of rare qualities, but what he has done there, I don't think has much impact beyond that day, except in ways I've said, and it has the possibility of damaging Abbas in the Middle East in the grounds that he consorted with the Crusader state.
The only thing is, I sometimes wonder, that it is face-to-face contact, isn't it? Sometimes it begins to change these things. You know, it's oddly when people meet away from their electorate, and they can suddenly begin a discussion.
Ultimately, I mean, I mean, ultimately, I think that, yeah, you're right, you get two people into a room, you never know, A, what's going to happen, but B, I mean, these talks have broken down. I mean, we really are kind of, you know, pushing against any which way to see where to go.
Wrong two people.
Well, yeah, I don't think it's going to go anywhere. I mean, he's not going to get lots of the key players to come to the Vatican. But I think it's a kind of symbolic thing for the Pope to do. I don't think it's going to cause any harm if it had
the leader of Hamas there as well, then we might have been talking about a kind of, you know, something perhaps more meaningful but more dangerous.
And something very much, much, much more controversial as well.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Kathleen Burke and Darren McCaffrey, thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, there's plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We're going to check in with one of our correspondents around the world, review the latest art openings in New York, and before the end of the programme... Oh yes, get out your dirndls, because we're going to be speaking to the author whose new book traces the history of musicals on film. But before we get started on that, here's Bill Bingham with the world news headlines.
Pakistan's busiest airport has reopened after a night-long assault by Taliban militants in which at least 28 people were killed. The violence at Jinnah International Airport in Karachi began just before midnight when 10 gunmen wearing military uniforms and armed with automatic rifles and grenades shot their way into the terminal building. A Spanish Air Force pilot has died after his Eurofighter jet crashed at a military base in southern Spain. Local media say the aircraft crashed into the ground while attempting to land at Moron base, 35 miles southeast of Seville. Brazilian riot police have been using tear gas against protesters in Sao Paulo 3 days before the World Cup opening game in the city's main stadium. The protest was called by metro workers who are striking in support of a 12.2% salary increase. Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe says Japan is to increase efforts to resume whale hunting in the Antarctic. The International Court of Justice ruled in March that Japan's whaling program was not for scientific research, as they had claimed. A Moscow court has sentenced two men to life in prison for killing an investigative journalist whose murder in 2006 raised international alarm. Anna Politkovskaya, who specialised in uncovering state corruption and rights abuses, was gunned down at her Moscow apartment block. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Bill, and welcome back to Midori House live here on Monocle 24. The time here in London is 18:32, which means it's 21:32 in Moscow and 14:32 in Rio de Janeiro. And it's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we head to Hungary, and our Budapest correspondent, Adam Labor, joins us now. Adam, thank you for coming on the show. Could you tell us, first of all, about these demonstrations, which is about the removal of an editor from Portal?
Yes, that's turning into quite a big story here. What happened was, at the end of last month, a news portal, a website called Origo.hu, which is one of the most popular news sites here, ran a story about a man called Janos Lazar, who now is probably one of the most powerful men in the country, is the chief of cabinet to the prime minister, and his expenses in various luxury hotels, on government business, it must be added, but they were quite high. And after the story was run, a week later or so, Mr. Lazar repaid the money, and the editor-in-chief of Origo departed. The Origo management says that it was by mutual agreement, but he told a news agency that it was not. So there's an awful lot of concern about this, and now about 20 journalists from Origo have resigned, including the whole news staff.
And how significant is Origo? Is it a big news outlet?
Yeah, it's very significant. There's two main news websites here. I mean, young people here don't buy newspapers. Newspapers in Hungary, daily newspapers are really a dying industry. The two main ones are either extremely pro-government or extremely pro the Socialist Party. So people seeking some kind of, you know, less partisan, more zappy news go to two websites called either Index or Origo, and there's a new one called 444. So the web is where most young people, especially the more urban and more educated ones, get their news from. So the departure of the editor and, you know, the mass resignation of 20 journalists out of about 60 is a big story here.
And just tell me, can they put pressure on Origo? Is it publicly owned? Is it privately owned? Is there some hint at how that influence worked?
Well, Origo is actually wholly owned by Magyar Telekom, which is a the mobile phone and internet infrastructure provider company, which is a subsidiary of Deutsche Telekom, the German company. And there was a big story on 444 alleging that the dismissal of the editor was connected somehow to a deal which Magyar Telekom had signed with the government to provide new infrastructure for high-speed internet around the country. Now, Magyar Telekom has strongly denied this and issued a very strong statement saying there's absolutely no connection and it has no influence over Origo whatsoever, and all decisions are taken by Origo's management. So, they deny it very strongly.
Well, let's just move on. There's another media story, which is the idea that the government now wants to tax advertising revenue. I'd have thought they'd have taxed the revenue of magazines anyway, but why is this significant?
Well, this is actually perhaps even more significant, because what it's managed to do is bring together 70 different media organizations in Hungary, which is a place where people are normally very partisan and either on one side or the other, for or against whichever government's in power. And they're saying that if this goes ahead, it's going to drive a lot of the media out of business. And the one who will be most affected is RTL Club, which is a commercial TV channel. And their revenues are the highest, so they say that they'll be forced to bear about 40% of the total national cost of this tax, which obviously, and they haven't said this, but I mean, clearly will make them wonder whether or not it's worth carrying on their business here. And real cynics say that actually there are some people who wouldn't be sorry to see RTL shut down, because it's commercial and it's independent, and it means more people would watch state television, which is really very pro-government and is, you know, almost laughable, really, in its lack of objectivity.
Now, there's still potential to do lots of development in Budapest. I know when we visited you there, it was amazing how many extraordinary buildings were still kind of not really kind of done up or even were empty. Now, there's a big building just being sold, the Drechsler Palace. What's all this about?
Well, that's a real landmark building. It's for a while it was that hosted the Ballet Institute, but it was built around at the end of the 19th century, and it's a gorgeous big building on the main kind of the main drag on the Pest side, which is called Andrássy Way, and it's been doing nothing for ages, and the whole of the streets around it and even the back streets around it are all being developed. And as you said, when Monaco had its big trip out to Budapest, you saw, you know, what amazing bars and restaurants and cafes and everything are springing up all over the place. So there's a lot of optimism now that now this has been resold, hopefully to owners that are actually going to do something with it instead of just leaving it sitting there.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Adam. That was Adam Labor, Monocle's correspondent in Budapest. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. And up next, we're going to be talking to Richard Barrios. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Midori House on Monocle 24.
This is it! That's the goal!
On this week's edition of The Foreign Desk, the World Cup in Brazil edges ever closer, but with the threat of more protests, will the tournament really be a boost for the country's soft power?
If something good has come out of it, it's the sense that the elites, both political and economic, who have been getting away with it for years, are being brought to order.
We also take a look at World Cup's past and judge the legacies they left.
The Bundesliga was successful before the World Cup, but in a country which is so football-driven like Germany, I think there's no question that new stadium developments are successful.
It was important for Spain. It gave the world an opportunity to know us better, because obviously, to the outside world, Spain was still associated with a number of taboos.
Jubilant scenes in South Africa as the 2010 World Cup finally gets underway. All the World Cup really did in the long term, apart from being a great coming out party for the nation, it just highlighted the inequalities and the problems of the country, which, frankly, any sort of good band of journalists could have done that. So I think that it was a very expensive way to highlight the problems that already existed.
That's World Cup Legacies, this week's edition of The Foreign Desk, with me, Steve Bloomfield, on Monocle 24.
Some people are on the pitch, they think it's all over. It is now.
Climb aboard the Africa Express with Monocle's Robert Bound as he straps in the jump seat for a jaunt around the Horn.
Berbera is where more passengers got on than there were seats for them to sit on. A subtle tussle ensued in which class, nationality, religion and the supposed seniority of each was played out. Why were the other passengers flying this route? Most shook their heads, some said business, as in it's none of yours.
Hop, skip and jump on the Africa Express, a photographic essay now playing in the films menu on monocle.com.
Well, welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. And now we're heading to the movies.
Oh, I love to climb a mountain and to reach the highest peak. But it doesn't thrill me half as much as dancing cheek to cheek. Oh, I love.
And to the musical on the silver screen. In a new book, the author Richard Barrios analyses the American film musical from its very beginnings in the 1920s well into the 21st century. Dangerous Rhythm covers box office successes as well as fiascos and explains the film musical's importance for American culture. Well, joining me live on the line from New Jersey now is the author of Dangerous Rhythm, Richard Barrios. Richard, thank you very much for coming on the show. Let's first of all start with the here and the now. Is it in an endangered species, the film musical?
I wouldn't say exactly endangered. It's in slightly better shape than it was maybe about 15 years ago. But it's never going to be a vastly proliferating species anymore. They're simply too expensive and too financially risky to come in the large numbers that they did when they were big, like in the 1940s or early 50s, something like that. So they're around, but they're just sort of a more rarefied species now.
And before we go back to the early days, just tell me, you know, of the musicals that make it today, I understand you're not so keen on a certain Mamma Mia, but tell me, are there good things that come through these days, and why don't you like that Mamma Mia?
I didn't find in Mamma Mia... And this is a personal
thing. No, don't hold back,
thing,
please.
Obviously. You know, I won't qualify it too much. I didn't find that they found a very valid way to connect the script with the songs. And you know, a lot of the jukebox shows will have that pitfall there, where there are pre-existing songs and the scripts don't connect very well with them. I thought in Mamma Mia, the failure of this was especially noticeable. We have another one, Jersey Boys, coming in just a couple of weeks now. So I'll be interested to see how that plays out.
Especially as you are currently a bit of a Jersey Boy yourself.
I just became one about a month ago, yes.
Congratulations.
Indeed.
Now let's go back to the very early days. So we're talking about Fred Astaire. We heard that clip there. You know, even for today's generation, you know, we know what it signifies. It signifies a great-looking guy, an amazing-looking woman. It's romance, it's escapism, it's glamour. But did that only work because, you know, America was having a really tough time? And this was escapism on a kind of, you know, on an epic tinsel scale.
That's a large part of it, because musicals were sort of a panacea during the Great Depression. And not only in the United States, but all over the world. And this is, of course, when the British film musical came into its own. Around that time, with people like Jesse Matthews. So that was part of it. But in the case of Mr. Astaire especially, a lot of it came from his genius for knowing how to partner another dancer or even a non-dancer, and to find the way for that partnership to connect to the audience in a more meaningful way than, say, a Mamma Mia, where everything's on the surface. And with Astaire, there were hidden currents with the music and the movement that were exactly what an audience needed, especially in the 1930s when his films became huge hits.
And you know, the title of your book, it is Why Movie Musicals Matter. For you, why do they matter?
I find that they matter when they work, and that isn't always the case, obviously, but that when they work, they have a particular penchant for tapping into dreams and making them seem reality and actualizing things that wouldn't be possible otherwise. And I think they do it in a way that nothing else really comes close to, not even fantasy film or literature or anything like that. They have, it's that connection between the spoken and the sung and the walked and the danced, and the way that kind of activates our dreamscapes a bit.
Now, for you give great reviews and great explanations of a huge number of films. But for anybody who's always like, I don't get musicals, you know, it's not for me, I don't know anything about it. Give me an example of a musical that you think is just a gem that people should know about.
Well, the most commonly cited film as being the greatest musical, very validly so, is Singin' in the Rain. And one of the great things about Singin' in the Rain is that that is a film where the script, the spoken word, is as important as the music because it is so good and so sharp and so funny. So that's a very good example of one that may have a broader appeal. And we can go back to Mamma Mia once again. If you like ABBA and don't like musical films, chances are you'll still enjoy a Mamma Mia. So it's a very particular thing, just as some musicals will themselves divide people. There are people who love Les Mis and people who hate it.
Now, just tell me, that relationship between what happens on stage and, you know, in theatres, you know, where there's a new musical every 5 minutes and, you know, they win Tony Awards every year, but it's you know, it's not moving into the musical world. You know, I just saw Once the other night, that's just transferred, Tony Award winner, you know, 2 years ago. Why is it that in the world of theatre, is it just cost, you know, that we're, you know, whatever, you know, whether you love Sondheim or you kind of want some schmaltz, it's there. But go to the movies, you're starved.
A lot of it is economics, and a lot of it also is that the particular escapism that musicals have always offered became for film audiences, starting maybe in the late 1970s and going onward, replaced with science fiction and action films and comic books and digital effects and superheroes. So a lot of that particular kind of spectacle and captivation has been displaced. And musicals now seem to, you know, a lot of the general public, fortunately not all of it, somewhat passé, somewhat faded, somewhat camp, not in a good way, whereas a theater audience has always been a little more rarefied, a little more specialized, so they've been able to sort of keep that affinity there.
No,
and also, as you said, it's a matter of economics, because they, in the old days of the Hollywood studios, they were, you know, they could do them, but now they're extremely expensive and are considered very risky.
Well, Richard, thank you for coming to the show. Your book, as I mentioned, is called Dangerous Rhythm, and I encourage everyone to check it out. Now, just before we go, we're going to have a song from Greece. Please tell me you quite liked it.
I like Greece very much. It is what it is, and it is for that genre. I think it's a perfect realization, and it still is, on some charts, considered the most financially profitable musical film of all time. So in some ways, obviously, it spoke to a great many millions
of
people.
Richard, we're going to see if it speaks to our audience as well. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. This is from the 1978 film Grease. This is We Go Together. Come on, let's get up. That was the cast of Grease there, and We Go Together. I'd have chosen Summer Nights, but anyway, there you go. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and time now to review the best and sometimes the worst in the worlds of television, cinema, theatre, books and more. And today, this is a bit of a gear change. Please prepare. We're going to move to the world of art from the world of musicals. And joining us now, live from New York, we're staying on that side of the world, with a review of the latest art openings there, is Charlotte Burns of the Art Newspaper. Charlotte, great to have you on, and sorry to kind of bring you in with the words of Greece there. But anyway, Kara Walker, she's quite a well-known artist already, and there's a new interesting show. Could you tell us all about this?
Yeah, absolutely. I think everybody in New York should go and see this. It's really one of the best shows in town right now, I'd say. Kara is, she's a very well-known artist, like you say. She is best known for her room-sized tableau of black cut paper silhouettes, which are set in the antebellum South. And they're quite controversial because the sort of delicacy of the figures is offset by the seriously depraved behavior they're taking part in. And she addresses very tough issues, largely focusing on slavery and America's troubled past. So this new work is really on a new scale for her. It's a 75-foot long sculpture as a centerpiece, which is a female who's utterly naked apart from a black mammy headscarf. And there's a procession of around, I think, 15 slave boys who carry baskets and bananas to her. And it takes place in the Domino Sugar Factory, which is now disused and is about to be demolished to make way for housing. So it's a sort of farewell to that space. And obviously, the sugar trade is directly related to the slave trade. So for Kara Walker, the opportunity to work on this large scale is something she's said no to in the past and hasn't really engaged in, because her work has caused a lot of controversy in the past, and taking it to such a public space comes with issues. But she said that the actual space itself and the history of it was too much for her to say no to.
And tell me, I was just going to ask you, Charlotte, it's interesting, I often think in London when you see artists respond to the Turbine Hall, which is obviously our example of, you know, a massive space where people have to kind of fill it and what they do with it. Do you think that she was successful in her use of, you know, of the epic?
I think so, yeah. And the Turbine Hall, it's a quite different space to that, because the Turbine Hall is, you know, has that sort of cathedral air that, you know, all big museums do. And it's been sanitized. And of course, it was formerly, you know, that area was formerly to do with warehousing. So there's a history. But it's, you know, in itself, the Tate is a completely different building with a completely different history, isn't a new one. Whereas this, you walk in, and the thing you don't get from the pictures, which are populating Instagram left, right, and center, is the smell. Before she could even set foot in the space, they had to clear away, I think it was a 6-inch layer of molasses. And as you walk into the space, it just sort of reeks of sugar, this sweet, slightly rank smell that comes through the space. And as I went last week, it's sunny here in New York, so a lot of the molasses are actually melting back into the space. It's sort of interesting, and it's very impressive. Every angle you look at it from, all you can sort of see is this you know, super large female figure who is absolutely naked and exaggeratedly so, and has in fact sparked a trend of Instagram selfies around her rear end.
Which probably isn't the greatest thing when it's something about the, you know, the power of slavery and things, to be doing Instagrams around her backside. But anyway,
yeah, exactly, an objectification of women. I mean, you know, yeah, we're continuing a long tradition here.
Okay, well, let's move on. Sam Moyer, another interesting artist, a young artist, and as a show that you've been to see, it sounds a little bit kind of cerebral. I'm just trying to work out exactly what it's about. Try and explain this for our audience.
Well, it's quite cerebral, but it's also visually impactful. Sam Moyer's a young artist, and she is showing in Rachel Ufner Gallery, which recently opened a new, much larger space on the Lower East Side. It's her third show with the gallery. It's called Heavyweight, and she uses all three spaces in this new gallery and shows a slightly different kind of work in each, but all of them riffing off the idea of heaviness and light weight. So as you walk in, there's a series of large works which are paintings on glass, sort of like a inverted stained glass, which she has sandwiched between or pressed upon painted fabric and plexiglass. Upstairs, there's a gorgeous body of wall works which are half marble and half dyed fabric, which she sort of used the fabric to complete the incomplete marble, and then mounted on wood. And then downstairs, there's a monumental site-specific installation, which is a vast slab of marble elevated around half a foot above the gallery floor and placed directly beneath an equally large swathe of dyed fabric. So the two sort of combined form a pedestal that plays with perceptions of light and space, becomes a sort of luminous runway, and visitors walk on this marble. So it's definitely visually appealing. She began as a conceptual artist, but she's moved more and more into objects and media. And you see her here making a step in a new direction. It's a very good direction for her, I think. Her work's taking a really bold step, and it will be interesting to see where she goes with that in the future.
And I understand that the title, More Weight, has a slightly dark meaning. It comes from Arthur Miller, doesn't it, in The Crucible, and this request by the character Giles Corey that he be pressed to death by stone slabs. So the work is, you know, when you see it, do you find it beautiful, or is it slightly disturbing? What was your gut instinct from seeing it?
I thought it was very refreshing, actually. For my job, I see a lot of contemporary art, and we're going through a phase right now with a lot of these galleries on the Lower East Side. There's a huge amount of speculation at that end of the market, and you're seeing much of the same kind of stuff, largely produced by young male artists. It's this sort of quasi-abstract, minimalist art, you know, very 2D, and it's very popular, selling for huge sums of money on the market, and not all of it, I would say, is particularly good. So it was very, it was just very refreshing from a sort of appreciation of art point of view to walk into a show that's putting on something slightly different, and the artist is clearly thinking about, you know, art history and tradition and where she's going with her career, and to see that at play is, it was a very good thing.
We've just got 1 minute left, which is a mean thing to do to you, but Albrecht Dürer's Melancholia is at the Met. In just a minute, just tell us what this is all about and why it's a good thing.
Okay, so it's the 500th anniversary of this work, so completely different to what we just spoke about. It's one of the most famous old master prints, and made by the German Renaissance artist Albrecht Dürer, who's sort of Europe's, he's super famous in Germany. He's been extremely influential upon bunches of artists, from the Die Brucke artists to, if you go to Polka, there's a riff on his hair work, the sort of rabbit. And he was very influential because he introduced sort of classical motifs to the German North, you know, North Europe, and he also was a theorist and introduced various ideas of maths, perspective, and proportion. So it's a very important work because it's been subject to, I think, probably one of the most amounts of speculation and interpretation of any old master print. And many take the idea that it refers to one of the types of melancholy described by the German humanist writer Cornelius Agrippa, which looks at the idea of the when the art is being held in more sway by the imagination than the mind.
I'm going to have to stop you there, Charlotte. You did a minute and 10 seconds. You almost got there for a minute, which is a tough gig for anybody to do. Charlotte, thank you so much, as always, for joining us from our offices there in New York. Charlotte is, of course, with the Art Newspaper. Well, that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guest, Kathleen Burke of University College London, and to Darren McCaffrey, a political correspondent with Sky News here in the UK. Today's show was produced by Thomas Lewis, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Harry Baker, and our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Next, after the headlines, it's Culture with Mr. Robert Bound. Then at 2200 hours, it's the Monocle Daily. The show will be back at the same time tomorrow. But from me, Andrew Tuck, it's just time to say goodbye.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world-famous, Oyster Perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.